Good morning.
For the record.
On November 21st, 2011, the U.S. Merit Systems Protection Board granted the U.S. Postal Service's motion for oral argument in 5 consolidated cases. The board will now hear oral argument in the following cases. Please bear with me. Latham versus U.S. Postal Service MSPB docket numbers DA-353-10-408-I-1. Turner versus USPS SF-353-10-329-I-1. Reeves versus USPS CH-353-10-823-I-1. Lundy versus USPS AT-353-11-369-I-1. And Albright versus USPS DC-752-11-196-I-1. The hearing is conducted pursuant to 5 CFR 1201-1117A2. Here today is the full board of the MSPB, the Vice Chair Ann Wagner, the member Mrs. Mary Rose, and myself, Susan Sway Grundman, Chairman, presiding. The parties are represented by counsel. The Office of Personnel Management, having submitted an advisory opinion in these cases, has declined the right to participate in oral argument. The board will now hear from Mr. Dowd, representing all 5 appellants. Good morning, Mr. Dowd.
Good morning. Chairman Grundman, Vice Chairman Wagner, Member Rose, good morning, and may it please the board. Thank you for the time today, and before I get into the merits, I would like to just say for the record, it is an honor and a privilege for me to represent these 5 employees of the Postal Service. This is Ms. Albright, Ms. Lundy, Ms. Reeves, Ms. Turner, and Mr. Latham. Together, they represent about 120 years of loyal service to the Postal Service. With that being said, I'd like to focus on the issues before the board today. In each of the 5 cases, the administrative judge erred because the national reassessment process on its face is arbitrary and capricious. That's so because the NRP violates the Postal Service's long-standing internal guidelines and regulations that govern the restoration of partially recovered Postal Service employees.
Mr. Dowd, I'm sorry to interrupt or to jump right in here so early, but did the Postal Service negotiate the NRP policy or implementation with the various unions that represent postal workers?
Based on the record that I've seen, I'm not certain that is the case. I don't believe that the NRP has been negotiated with these 5 individuals. I'm almost certain of that. But my understanding of the NRP is that it almost amounts to a unilateral decision by the Postal Service to modify and change the status of these 5 individuals who were restored under the Postal Service's long-standing guidelines and rules that govern partially recovered employees.
But the question is not necessarily about the NRP itself. The question is about the agency's rules and whether we have the jurisdiction to hear cases like this.
Yes, Chairman Grundman, that's correct. And the question is jurisdiction, and the jurisdiction for the board is set under 5 CFR 353. And that's 353.301C, 353.301D, and 353.304C. Both of those work together. And there the issue is whether the Postal Service's actions are arbitrary and capricious.
But what about the agency's argument that the statute really only applies to fully recovered or those who have overcome their disability and to be restored to a full or a whole position?
Well,
and
Chairman,
we don't have jurisdiction.
Sure, Chairman Grundman, that is, in my opinion, a completely separate issue. What the board did in its announcement in the federal regulations is presented 2 issues for consideration by the 5 appellants and the parties here. Neither of those issues addressed the authority of OPM to promulgate the rules in 353. Right? What the Postal Service has done here is sort of tried to shift the focus of what's being discussed today. And if you read the Postal Service's brief carefully, and I think even a generous reading of the Postal Service's brief in this case, in these cases, they never ever dispute the fact that the NRP is inconsistent with their rules and regulations that have been in place for 30 years. What they've tried to do is present a new issue to the board. And what they presented is an issue that has not been raised in any of the five cases before the administrative judge. And under the,
so are you suggesting we shouldn't consider it at all based on the fact that it wasn't raised below?
I think that's the strongest point, Vice Chairman Wagner, because under this court's precedent in Banks, this board requires parties to raise issues before the administrative judge, before the board itself, the full board, will consider it. And I don't think there's any question that that issue hasn't been presented. And it's even more telling in the fact that the board, and I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with this, but when the board issued the order explaining the procedure of the oral argument here today, what the board had to do is add those two issues. And so those are now presented as issues 3 and 4 in terms of the authority of OPM to promulgate those rules. And so that's just one, that's just the main point about the
board. But if the Postal Service raised those arguments as a result of our having requested OPM for an advisory opinion with regard to an interpretation of its regulations, I mean,
yes.
I think it could be argued that that issue was interjected by the board. So why shouldn't we consider it as a matter that's been properly raised before us at this point?
Stated another way, if we don't have jurisdiction to hear this case, we don't have jurisdiction.
The board's jurisdiction is not plenary.
I think those are two questions. Let me address Vice Chairman Wagner's question first, if I may. In terms of it being arguably implicitly raised in the question presented to the OPM, I don't think that's even a question. Because if you look at OPM's response, and if you look at the question presented to the OPM, the only question presented was the interpretation of 353 and the scope of 353. And in their response, what does OPM focus on? OPM focuses on the Supreme Court's longstanding precedent in multiple cases, Vitarelli versus Seaton, right? Service versus Dulles. These multiple cases that say that an agency, even if not bound by statute or regulation, if that agency promulgates stricter regulations, the agency has to follow it. And that's what OPM addressed in their letter in response to the board. OPM did not address the authority under 8151 to promulgate the rule. And that's a completely different issue. And in fact, there's a D.C. Circuit case, Railway Labor Executives Association from 1994, that explains that those two issues are distinct. Now, I think that's a very strong case where the Postal Service has waived that argument. They never presented it below. And it's I'll admit that it could be a complex issue, and I'm happy to discuss the merits of that as well today. But the point here is that no administrative judge has addressed the specific question of whether OPM has the authority to promulgate that rule. In fact, the Postal Service, in its brief at page 7, complains that OPM doesn't address it. OPM doesn't address it because the question wasn't presented. And I think it's really telling in the fact that the only party here today that has addressed the question, the ultra vires question, is the Postal Service. Neither of the amicus briefs have addressed it, none of the parties have addressed it, and they haven't quite simply because it wasn't raised.
Are you saying that we cannot raise it sua sponte?
I think that would be unwise at this point. I mean, I'm not saying that it's probably not within the power of the board, but given the issues that were fairly presented and the time spent on this case, if the Postal Service wants to take up that fight, there are probably plenty of other cases that the Postal Service can do. I'm also happy to address that.
Please do.
The substance of it, right? Well, the second point, I would argue that the Postal Service is judicially estopped. They've adopted affirmatively in a number of the cases below the fact that 8151 gives the OPM the authority to promulgate the rules at 353. Another point.
In other words, they haven't raised it before in any other forum.
It's slightly different. It's not only that they haven't raised it, but in their briefs to the AJs, they've actually stated that 8151 is the source of authority for 353. Okay. So it's related but a little different. The other thing I would say is that what the Postal Service tries to do in terms of the authority to promulgate the rule issue is that it looks at the statute and without citing a single case in its 6 pages of the brief, they just go on and say, this is what the text means. But in my view, the text isn't that clear. It never defines what is meant by overcome. And when you look at the history of 8151, and this is also set out in the Postal Service's brief, but they don't really, I think they try to slide by it, is that prior to 8151 being adopted in 1974, it's pretty clear that employees didn't have to recover 100% to be restored to a position. If you look at the legislative history of FICA, there are two explicit statements in the legislative history that address this issue. And Congress explicitly said that the goal and the intention of FICA was to cover partially recovered employees. There's no question about that, and the Postal Service adopts that.
But it is true that that clear statement occurs in legislative history, and the language of the statute on its face doesn't appear to address partially recovered individuals at all, isn't it? At least in the 74.
And I'll adopt that, and I think that's a fair reading of the statute. And because the statute doesn't directly address the issue under Chevron, what the courts and the board, I think the proper way to look at the statute is you look at the agency that has the authority to administer the statute. 8151B explicitly says that OPM has the authority to administer the statute. So OPM gets Chevron deference in terms of interpreting the statute.
But you only get to Chevron deference if the statute is unclear.
If the statute is unclear or it's silent on the issue. And the statute is silent in terms of the complete definition of overcome. And when you look at the legislative history, when you look at the 30 years that OPM and the Postal Service itself has interpreted the statute, and if you look at how other circuits have interpreted this statute, it's pretty clear that up until August 24th, 2011, when the Postal Service submitted this brief to the board, everyone had the understanding that 8151 in FICA covered partially recovered employees.
So your argument is that the ambiguity is in overcome. Are there any other terms in FICA that you deem ambiguous?
I think if you look at overcome, and I think if you look at, let me just pull it up. If you look at overcome, and if you look at it read in the context of suitable position, so it's the same or suitable position, I think if you look at those terms holistically, you have to understand that Congress did not speak directly in the text of the statute with respect to fully recovered.
What about equivalent positions?
Pardon?
What about equivalent positions?
Equivalent positions. I would agree with that as well, too. I mean, there's no definition of equivalent positions in the statute. And so there the question under Chevron, you know, is that term defined or is it clear on its face? And I'd submit to the board that it's not. And you have to look at the context of FICA, the legislative history, and the longstanding understanding of both OPM, the Postal Service, and the courts.
If you look at the language in B1 and B2, you mentioned the ambiguity in the word overcome, but to me, it actually comes before that, which is in B1. You have where the injury or disability has been overcome, and then in B2, if the injury or disability is overcome. What is there anything to be made of this different usage of tense that the Congress employed here? I mean, can we read into, if we were going to read into the statute at all, could we read into the is overcome a concept of, you know, an ongoing process of overcoming, as opposed, which would encompass the partially recovered individuals?
Vice Chairman Wagner, I think that's a perfectly reasonable interpretation of the statute. And the ultimate question under Chevron is whether the agency's interpretation is reasonable. I mean, any ambiguity, I'm not going to come up here and advocate that this is a crystal clear statute, right? It wasn't, because it was all drafted as a short statute. And when you think about all of what goes on in the federal government in terms of restoring injured employees within these, you know, two paragraphs of statutory text, there is no way that 8151 can be viewed as covering every possible scenario. And that's, I think, precisely why Congress wrote that in 8151B2, under regulations issued by the Office of Personnel Management, Congress intended for OPM to fill in the gaps. And that's exactly what OPM has done over the past 35 years.
But the problem is in part due to the fact that this 1966 version of PICA did arguably plainly encompass, in the language of the statute itself, the partially recovered individuals. And so the 74 amendments, in terms of, you know, you talk about ambiguity and silence, I mean, one could argue, and I'm sure the Postal Service will, that, and has, that the fact that that the 74 amendments do not specifically address partially recovered individuals is to indicate congressional intent to actually exclude them from coverage of the statute. What do you say to that?
Well, I think that's just an improper reading, because what you're doing there is inferring congressional intent based on silence in the statute, and the inference there is actually directly contrary to the explicit statements in the legislative history. And with that being said, I would like to turn to just a couple of the other issues, because I am running short on time. In terms of the first question, may denial of restoration be arbitrary and capricious solely for being in violation of the agency's own internal rules? I think there's absolutely no question about the correct answer to that, and here it's clearly yes. Postal Service has violated the ELM and the EL-505. The Postal Service doesn't dispute it in their briefs. Supreme Court precedent, Federal Circuit precedent, other circuit court precedents clearly say that an agency has to abide by its regulations, even if the agency gratuitously promulgates regulations that are stricter than what is required under the statute.
Let's say we agree with you on that point. Let's take it to the next step. Is there an unconditional right to restoration? And does work have to be available? I mean, what makes work available and unavailable?
Chairman Grumman, there's no absolute right to being restored. I think that's pretty clear for partially recovered employees. But what the Postal Service does have to do is just comply with the steps and the procedures it set forth in its own regulations and rules, which are clearly set forth in the ELM and the EL-505. So if for each of these five individuals today, if the Postal Service can demonstrate and prove that the Postal Service complied with ELM and EL-505 and there was no work available and they couldn't make work, because under 546.222 in the ELM, the Postal Service acknowledges that it has a duty to actually, you know, make work, not, you know, silly work, but it has to combine tasks so that it could accommodate the medical restrictions of the employee. So it doesn't have to just be open vacancies.
So if they're not classified positions, how do they define what work is available?
Once again, you go to the ELM and you go to EL-505 and you look at the medical restrictions of the individual. And this is, again, set forth in 353, where part of figuring out whether it's arbitrary or capricious is you look at the circumstances of each case.
And so what if somebody was doing it on overtime, somebody in the same craft was performing the same type of work overtime, would that make the work unavailable or available?
Are you referring to another individual?
Yes.
Yes. And they're doing the work in overtime?
Yes. Say it's in the same craft.
In the same graph, I think that's, if you go through the procedure that's set forth in the Postal Service's guidelines, I think that's available work.
That would be available work.
And it also makes sense. Why would the Postal Service want to pay extra to have someone do it in overtime when they could have a fully capable individual within their medical restrictions to do that work?
So if, well, if an employee has a job, an eight-hour job, and this employee has 6 hours of heavy-duty work, lifting bags of 60 pounds or whatever, and then 2 hours is just sweeping up the letters that fall out of the bags, right?
Yes.
This is an exaggerated example. So do they just snap that right out of that guy's job description and give it, make another available work situation? Is that how they do it?
I'm not sure they do it that way, but again, it has to be done with respect to the procedures set forth in the Elm. In the Elm, it has a pretty clear table that shows the Postal Service what to do. And it also, keep in mind, it also has to, you have to restore the employee, the partially recovered employee, in a way that doesn't detrimentally affect current employees with respect to seniority, for example. I only have 1 minute of my rebuttal time, so
we'll take care of it.
Okay.
I have a question. These cases actually involve employees who were working in modified assignments and then being reassigned or denied that work. So, I mean, in that instance, I mean, is the fact that they were performing the work at all prima facie evidence that it was available?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, under the Elm, because these five individuals, they were all restored as partially recovered employees under the Postal Service's guidelines that have been in existence for about 30 years. What happened is the NRP came along, they changed their way, and what's also notable is that, and this is again another example of arbitrary, capricious action by an agency, the NRP was in effect for a certain amount of time, and as of January 31st, 2011 of this year, the Postal Service is no longer implementing the NRP, and they've stated in a letter, I'm not sure if this is in the record, but Mr. Bubb, I'm sure he can confirm this, they're going back to the provisions that are set forth in the Elm. So the way I understand it, if my five clients, Postal Service employees, if they apply for restoration today, they could possibly get it back.
Let me ask you one question. One of the unions argued that the board should defer adjudication of these cases to the party's collective grievance procedure. Do you have a position on that?
Yeah. Yes, Chairman Grundman. I don't see any reason to defer. The board's jurisdiction is set forth in 353, 5 CFR 353. You have an obligation to carry out the board's duty. Now, of course, if there is some strong, compelling reason to defer, you might want to consider that. But, and I believe this is the APWU's brief, now, they only cite one case. They cite no other cases that support the reason for deference. And the other thing to keep in mind is that the board's jurisdiction with respect to restoration of employees is limited to denials of restoration. So if you get into it, an issue of whether the actual restoration was appropriate or sufficient or consistent with the medical restrictions, that's something that goes over to OWCP. And that maybe that's something that's more appropriate to be dealt with in the grievance procedure. But here, the board does have an obligation to carry out its regulatory mandate.
Thank you, Mr. Dowd. We'll give you an additional.
Sure. Okay. I would like to ask a question. It is clear that the board has ruled that substantive rights provided by the federal law and regulation to employees who have partially recovered from a compensable injury are limited to restoration to a position that constitute a separate and distinct unencumbered position. Now, this has been since the Civil Service Reform Act, and yet you explain that we're making available work that aren't classified positions for employees.
Yes.
And I would like to ask you, wouldn't the board have exceeded its legal rights or its authority in restoration appeals by making a decision on this? We're speaking purely of contractual rights. You know, and again, I think that maybe negotiated grievance procedure would be the proper forum for this.
Member Rose, I appreciate that question and concern. I have a couple points on that. First is, although there are contractual rights implicated in this case, it's not solely contractual rights. These are rights that are set forth in the agency's regulations and guidelines. And if you look at 39 CFR I forget the section, but what it does, it explicitly incorporates into the regulations sections of the ELM and the ELM in itself. And what ELM 546.222 states is that with respect to reassignment or reemployment of a partially recovered employee, such assignment may be to a residual vacancy or to a position uniquely created to fit those restrictions. However, such assignment must not impair seniority rights of PTF employees. Now, with respect to a prior board decision that might have ruled contrary to what is set forth in the ELM, I'm not really certain in terms of the timing of this. It might have been that the ELM was different in the past, and honestly, it might have been that that board decision is not correctly decided. But here, under the Supreme Court precedent, under circuit precedent, what the agency is obligated to do is to comply with the regulations that it has set forth. And as far as I can tell, my review of the record, the Postal Service does not dispute that their conduct under the NRP is not consistent with their regulations. Thank you.
Mr. Dowd, save 5 more minutes. Next, we have Mr. Secular for Amicus Curiae, National Association of Letter Carriers. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. May it please the board, thank you for the opportunity to address you. Let me state at the outset that NALC agrees with the Postal Service that the question of limited duty is fundamentally a contractual issue. And those disputes over the assignment of limited duty, as a general rule, can be resolved in the party's grievance arbitration procedure. But having said that, we believe that as to the pure legal issue that's presented here, the appellants do have the better argument, and that the regulation, which gives employees the option of appealing disputes over limited duty to the board, is in fact consistent with the statute. Now, Mr. Dowd has addressed the ambiguity arising over the word overcome. We think it's telling that the statute does not use the term full recovery. There's no reason to assume that overcome is synonymous with full recovery. In fact, it's reasonable in our view to suggest that an employee who was injured and has recovered to the point where he or she can assume productive work with the Postal Service has overcome the injury.
Let me pick up where the Vice Chair started with Mr. Dowd. Yeah. Did the agency bargain the National Reassessment Program with the unions?
No.
With respect to provisions governing the ELM and the EL, are there local agreements that further asphyxiate?
There can be local agreements or local practices.
Okay, and what do those look like? What impact do they have?
Well, local practices are looked to on a case-by-case basis by arbitrators in resolving these disputes. Maybe I should address Member Rose's line of inquiry or maybe perhaps Vice Chairman Wagner's about how the work is deemed available. Overwhelmingly, these cases are about limited duty that is taken away from employees. And what happens is the focus of the inquiry is the work still there? The reason we have an NRP, the reason we have such an explosion in the number of cases is that the Postal Service's workload is shrinking. Everyone knows that. And so what happens is you have disputes over whether work that was given to injured employees still exists. And when the employees prevail on the grievance procedure, the union is successful in showing that the work has not disappeared, that in fact the work that had been given to the employee was reassigned to somebody else. Typically that's perhaps a non-career employee, or it may be to an employee who is now performing the tasks on overtime. And so if the tasks still exist, then there is no justification under the Postal Service's regulations for taking it away from the employee.
Well, going down that line of reasoning, then an employee's rights under the ELM and the EL can trump the operational needs of an agency.
Yes. Well, it depending on how you define operational needs. The regulations, as we see it, do not permit the Postal Service to make the most efficient choice to assign work to an able-bodied employee because that able-bodied employee can do the work more quickly, for example. It does have an obligation to, under its own regulations, to restore the employees to work and to provide them with limited duty if the work is there.
Well, when can the operational needs of an agency trump, loosely speaking, the EL and the EL?
Well, we don't recognize operational needs as a relevant concept in these cases. In our view, the issue is the work there? And again, I want to emphasize that the cases come up because work had been given to the employee. The Postal Service, back in the day when these regulations were formulated, was doing everything it could to bring injured employees back to work and make them productive because the Postal Service is on the hook for the compensation costs. And it is only in this new era of shrinking mail volume and work disappearing that we now have disputes over whether work exists. But if the work exists, the regulations, which admittedly were crafted in a different era, do require the Postal Service to give the work to the employee if it's within the employee's medical restrictions and if the work is still exists and is available to the employee.
What does that mean, if it still exists, in the sense of, is there some objective financial, economic rationale for continuing?
Well, mail volume may have shrunk to the point that there isn't enough work to occupy an employee who can't go out on the street and deliver it, but was just casing it, for example.
Okay, so the idea of make work is really inconsistent with your formulation that the task still exists.
Right. We're not talking about counting paper clips. We're talking about work that normally has to get done by somebody for the Postal Service to function.
So there's no
way. There's also another example, this may make more sense, is there's a lot of consolidation going on in the Postal Service right now, and work mail is being routed through different post offices. So if an employee was working in the office to case mail in an office, that mail may now be cased in some other office and may no longer exist.
Oh, so it's like exists per local.
Within each office. Yeah, the focus is local, under the regulations.
So, if the postal, so does the union concede that the Postal Service can unilaterally determine whether that task is still exists or not?
No, that's normally what is the inquiry. It's a fact case-by-case inquiry. That's usually what the issue is. Does the task still exist?
And is someone else doing it?
That's normally how the union proves that the task still exists, by showing that another employee is doing it.
But another employee could be doing it at a different location.
Right.
That's...
Right. Another employee within the same office.
What about a different office?
Well, that's getting harder and harder to make that case, but it could be made. Employees generally are fighting to remain in the office where they're assigned. And it's increasingly difficult to get employees assigned to limited duty work in another office because they're normally employees there who need the limited duty work.
So I'm sure you're familiar with the 50-mile radius concept that we have generally incorporated into determining these types of cases. I mean, that would seem to exceed beyond the specific office inquiry that you're talking about.
Well, that's, I would say that, yes, that's different. The regulations to that extent differ from the concept of a commuting area for restoration. I'm not saying that the employees, when they come here, will be arguing the exact same concepts and rules that they would be in the context of a grievance procedure.
But I'm just confused, but it does sound like that the grievance, the contractual right now sounds actually more narrow than the regulatory right to restoration.
In other words, it's beyond the facility.
The contractual right is to work outside the facility. It's the reason I'm hesitating to answer is because the regulations were set up to prevent employees from being transferred out of their office The origin of the regulation was had to do with...
Are you talking about CFR or the ELM?
The ELM.
Okay.
The ELM was changed in 1979 by virtue of an agreement between the union and the Postal Service. That was done because, in the union's view, the Postal Service was exploiting the limited duty options by assigning people to graveyard shifts and distant offices to discourage them from making compensation claims. And so the protections were incorporated into the ELM to allow employees to work their normal schedules in their home offices. So moving outside their office is actually a last resort under the regulations.
That's the pecking order, correct?
That's the pecking order.
And at some point down the pecking order, there is the right to go beyond the facility.
Right.
But that's
I can't say that there couldn't be a case where someone is claiming work in a distant office under the pecking order, but that would be very rare. Usually the focus is not being sent to another office.
I'm still having difficulty with the legal authority that the board has to restore someone to a task rather than a separate or distinct position.
Yes, Member Rose, thank you for raising that. I think there's an obfuscation going on here between the concept of a position and the concept of an assignment. All these employees have positions. And I think if you read the Anchetta line of cases on disability retirement, that it becomes very clear. An employee who is reassigned to limited duty has an on-the-rolls complement position of city letter carrier. What may change is the tasks that the employee is assigned, the duty assignment. And for example, when Anchetta applied for disability retirement, the board concluded that her modified letter carrier job was not a separate position. But that didn't mean Anchetta didn't have a position. Instead, it meant that her position remained, as it does for these limited duty letter carriers, city letter carrier. The positions in the Postal Service have standard descriptions in their regulations, and anyone on the complement has a position of record. So these limited duty employees, they come back to work, they are still on the rolls as city letter carriers, but they may have a modified assignment. It doesn't mean they don't have a position. When they have these modified assignments, they're still being restored to a position which we think easily fits within the notion of an equivalent position under the statute.
But what's a position without any assignments? What does that become?
There is a position or a concept in the Postal Service of unassigned regular. That happens all the time. A letter carrier could have his route abolished, for example. And he could go from having a delivery route that he delivers every day to having no set duties and be assigned to different duties each day, filling in for other carriers because the route no longer exists. That has nothing to do with injuries.
Well, let me ask you this. Let's go the next step further. Yeah. Sam, I'm a partially recovered employee coming up with an unassigned regular person. Who gets what?
It depends on what the injured letter carrier has been doing. I don't know off the top of my head, and I'm not sure the Postal Service would be on the hook if work has been assigned to an unassigned regular. I don't know that the injured letter carrier necessarily gets priority for work he's never done before.
So then that would be work unavailable if it's the same crime.
Yes.
But these cases involve people who've been sent home. Yeah. So what does it mean for them to have the position? I'm unclear about that. But they're not actually working, and I presume they're not getting paid if they're not actually working.
That's right. But when they are working, they have a position as part of the complement as city letter carrier. I'd ask the board to recall that the board has recognized that positions in the Postal Service don't line up with the standard civil service definitions. And in the Anchetta line of cases, the question of what is a position, what the employee's position is, was treated as an issue of fact. In fact, I believe all those cases were remanded to the administrative judge for findings on that issue. And I think the recognition was that it's specific to each individual. But there is always a position of record when someone is on the rolls and working for the Postal Service.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, we have Mr. Anderson, amicus curiae for the American Postal Workers Union.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning. May it please the board. I'm Daryl Anderson, as you know, and represent the American Postal Workers Union. On behalf of the American Postal Workers Union, thank you for making this time available. I want to start with the issue of jurisdiction. It seems to me the board needs to consider whether and how to give meaning to the words arbitrary and capricious. Because as you look at contract violations, which is what ELM violations are, the ELM is incorporated by reference into the collective bargaining agreement. As the board looks at those contract violations, if every contract violation becomes arbitrary and capricious, I mean, that's almost an oxymoron. We have thousands of arbitration cases every year in the Postal Service.
You have a statement in your brief, and that was kind of curious to me. I mean, you state that not every violation of the ELM is arbitrary and capricious.
Right.
What, in your opinion, would not be arbitrary and capricious?
Well, for example, and I guess I want to start the other way, if I may, and that is that when the NRP arguably was arbitrary and capricious, because the Postal Service they didn't negotiate it. They brought the NRP in and slammed it in and took people off jobs where the work was still there. That's pretty arbitrary. On the other hand, it may well be, and we've had many cases, we've arbitrated many cases under 546 of the ELM, where the issue becomes, was there work available? And also, 546 of the ELM, for example, requires the Postal Service to respect seniority rights of other employees. And so often there's a conflict between the employees, some of whom may be represented by one union, some of whom may be represented by another union. And we've had arbitrations where the issue becomes, did the Postal Service correctly apply the contract? Now, that is a garden variety contract interpretation case. It may well be that the supervisors and managers applying in that case were looking at the 505, looking at the 546, looking at the collective bargaining agreement, and we're trying in good faith to figure out what to do. What were their obligations? It's not clear. And they might have made a mistake, but the arbitrator will tell them whether or not they made a mistake 6 months after they make their decision. And so to say that every mistake they make is arbitrary and capricious, it seems to me, is not correct. It's arbitrary when they come in and say, nothing has changed. No contract has changed. No fact has changed. The work is still there. We're taking this new program and we're taking you out of your job. That's pretty arbitrary. And we think it violated the contract. It violated the regulations. But not every case is arbitrary. In fact, most of them are not. I've spent my career arguing that the Postal Service has made mistakes. That's what I do for a living. And they make mistakes all the time. And sometimes they're arbitrary, but not most of them, frankly, aren't. They try to do their job. They try to interpret the contract. It's my job to disagree with them when they're wrong, and I do that. But it seems to me not necessarily arbitrary just because they're wrong.
Mr. I found the APW's argument in this regard somewhat curious, because it seems like what you're trying, number one, you're going actually to the merits of the arbitrary and capricious determination. I mean, a contractual violation arguably makes a non-frivolous allegation of arbitrary and capricious denial. It would be then a question of getting to the merits of that, whether in fact there was, the denial, the contractual violation reached the level of arbitrary and capriciousness. That's really what you're getting at. And I'm just curious, why is the APW taking that position in this case when the issue is about really our jurisdictional authority and whether, individual postal employees can come in and attempt to seek relief at the board for arguably arbitrary and capricious denials.